The news from France is grim. Since the 1980s, the nation has lost nearly 70% of its nightclubs. Gone, silent. The situation in Italy is just as dire. More than half have closed in the last 30 years. Friday night on the town has all but disappeared worldwide. People are still drinking, dancing and having sex, but nightlife is changing, which makes Imogen Willett's new book, Up All Night, A History of Going Out, particularly useful right now by charting the shifts and changes in nightlife from 500 years ago. Imogen, who is a writer and event producer, can we hope give us a guide to the future of good times? Imogen, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
You argue that the big night out has become a fringe activity. Why?
Well, I think there are lots of different reasons at play. I think there's a kind of perfect storm, really, where, you know, you think of the impact that smartphones have had on the way that we socialize. We're much more atomized, we're more likely to spend time at home, you know, a great night in with a Deliveroo and a Netflix film at home has for some people replaced the big night out. And young people today have much less disposable income than they did maybe 20 or 30 years ago. More of their earnings are going on rent. So it's created a really, really difficult time for nightlife. You know, it was an industry that was particularly suffered during COVID, and it has not really been able to bounce back since then. So it is very much, yeah, an industry going through a difficult time at the moment. But I hope that, you know, more better nights out are to come, that this isn't the end of nightlife, that perhaps we're in a bit of a transition phase.
Those damned things, those phones that we can't live without. Mm. You don't need to meet strangers, do you?
Mm-mm. I think it is a sad thing that for many people, interacting with people online through social media has replaced, you know, face-to-face interaction. And I think that whilst obviously there are great online communities that are supportive and wonderful, and you know, that's a real positive of the social media world that we live in, I think we're naturally, you know, we're social animals, and we need that real life interactive connection, and we need to be doing that much more than we currently are.
I don't want to go into details, but there is something particularly thrilling about finding yourself dancing with about 4,000 other people.
Yes, exactly. And the sociologist Emile Durkheim came up with a wonderful expression to describe that exact experience. He calls it collective effervescence, which is the high, the euphoric high that we get being among crowds. And that is exactly how it feels, you know, losing your sense of individualism, losing your sense in the crowd, collective effervescence, that's what it's called.
And in the days before telephones were taking photographs of one another, it was more than effervescence.
Exactly. That there were these, incredible social spaces before the smartphone era of meeting people, you know, coming up with wild ideas for art, culture, dancing, music. It was a real kind of engine of cultural innovation that happened on these dance floors. They are not just frivolous, superfluous spaces that are just there for fun. There is something about the way that they move culture forward too that's also really important.
Let's go back, I mean, as you do in the book, to 17th century Japan, because what you trace in the book are places and ways of enjoying ourselves. They're for the most part commercial, and they are sort of pioneering enterprises. 17th century Japan, what had they developed there in Yoshiwara?
Yeah, so Yoshiwara, it really is an extraordinary place and absolutely the beginning of modern nightlife. So it was the only place of public entertainment that was given permission by the shogun. You know, basically we're talking about a military dictatorship here, you know, the kind of equivalent of North Korea style, you know, control over people's lives. And Yoshiwara was given permission to stay open all night, which is a privilege granted to no other place of public entertainment. And Edo, which is now Tokyo, was an incredibly male-dominated city. So men outnumbered women by about 2-1. And you had this incredible sense of competition between the merchants who were getting incredibly rich. You know, domestic trade was booming. They had enormous amounts of wealth, but were also quite restricted in what they could do with it. So Yoshiwara provided this incredible outlet for them to just have these unbelievably flashy, expensive nights out. And then you have the samurai warriors who were revered, very well educated, kind of disciplined warriors, but were kind of at the top of the sort of social status. But they did not have the spending power of the merchants. And so Yoshiwara would have been an incredibly sort of strange place to watch this competition play out between these two types of men, the merchants and the samurai.
But not necessarily a great place for women.
Yes, exactly. So that is part of the dark side of Yoshiwara. You know, it was this, if you were going there as a customer, as a male customer, women were not allowed in other than the sex workers who lived and worked there, that the male customers obviously were having the best times of their lives. But for women, it was a completely different story. I mean, they were effectively imprisoned inside Yoshiwara. So there was absolutely a dark side to it. And it's also interesting to think about the dangers of nightlife before electricity. So Yoshiwara was incredibly kind of densely packed, densely populated, which added to this incredible atmosphere at night. But it was built in wood, you know, paper, these paper lanterns and walls and that kind of thing. It was essentially a kind of tinderbox city. And it did burn down very, very regularly. And there's something so sort of chilling and Orwellian about the idea that, you know, I think there was one decade where there was something like 5 fires that just completely obliterated Yoshiwara. And every time it burned down, it was just built up the exact same street pattern, the exact same layout, exactly as it was, just built up as a perfect duplication. And there's something, yeah, that I think very Orwellian about that. Just a reminder of how dangerous nightlife was before electricity.
But even now, those reports of deaths in fires in nightclubs have a particular poignancy, don't they?
They do, they do. There is something about, you know, this attempt at creating a space that's joyous, utopian, inclusive, you know, all of these things which make nightlife so, so special, and then being harmed through doing that. I completely agree. There is something that is particularly chilling about those sorts of disasters.
So I presume much safer was the British invention of Vauxhall Gardens in the 18th century.
Yes. So Vauxhall Gardens, so we still don't have electricity by the time we get to Vauxhall, but the conditions, obviously the, you know, weather in England, often you get pretty damp, wet summers, and it was just not densely built up in the way that Yoshiwara was, so it was a much kind of safer environment. But yeah, Vauxhall still was kind of having its fun with with fires and things like that. So there was one particular trend that lasted about 50 years called volcanomania that began in about the 1750s. And that was because Pompeii had just been discovered, it was starting to be excavated, and people in the West were obsessed with this idea of volcanic destruction. And so a night out for people in 18th century London would have meant watching a spectacular volcanic eruption show. This is, you know, building a mock Pompeii, building an enormous volcano, and then destroying the whole thing with pyrotechnics and fire and fireworks. And you know, 5,000-10,000 people would be gathered in this night garden to watch these shows. It's kind of like the blockbuster cinema, the Christopher Nolan of their time. Absolutely puts our modern nightlife today in London, I think, to shame.
Right. But is it true of all of these great places of entertainment that the normal rules of class distinction don't apply, that you are going to mix and that you're going to mix across the classes?
Yes, absolutely. I think that is the appeal of nightlife, the sense of transgression, the sense of being able to be someone different to your day-to-day life and interacting with people that perhaps you might not ordinarily meet. And I think that was absolutely part of the thrill of Vauxhall, because it was semi-illuminated, you know, it was still fairly dark. They had these incredible sort of bewitching candle lights that lit up some of this garden, but it was a dark space. And people would be so dressed up to go there that there's a lot of poems and song lyrics from the time that talk about this anxiety of not knowing what class people are from. And that was something that did lead to a sense of upheaval or turbulence and anxiety about the class system being upended. But it was also very thrilling to think, is this a member of the aristocracy or is it an incredibly well-dressed lady's maid? You know, you actually couldn't tell. And that was part of the thrill.
Yes, yes. And it was sexy.
Exactly, exactly. And I think you get just, you know, apologies to sort of jump around, but I think you get an echo of that in Studio 54, because you have this amazing mix of, you know, ordinary people, art school kids, celebrities, you know, the musicians, rock stars and ordinary kind of tourists all partying together. And because everyone was so dressed up with these amazing creative looks, you actually couldn't tell, you know, are you a model or are you some kid from downtown that's got a fake ID and managed to get your way in? You know, that was part of the allure. So I do think this sense of ambiguity of identity is a really exciting part of nightlife.
I want to jump back to Vauxhall Gardens for just yes. one more detail. The dark, yes. the dark walks of Fox yes. of Vauxhall. What were they?
Yeah. So that was the least illuminated part of Vauxhall. So if you can imagine, that's where all of the kind of sordid, sleazy stuff was going on. That's where people were hooking up, having sex, all this kind of thing. And there were many attempts. You know, Vauxhall was open for 200 years, many attempts by different managers to shut off the dark walk just because they felt kind of embarrassed about it. This was a fairly sleazy place. But there was one attempt where to close down the dark walk, and a riot broke out because people were so desperate to have this place where they could go and get up to all kinds of sleazy but fun things.
It's called a beat in modern day. And Imogen, I don't reckon management tried terribly hard to shut it down.
You're probably right, yeah.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Imogen Willits about a subject that matters deeply, the history of going out. Now, Imogen, gardens, the notion of the pleasure garden went global, didn't it? Did it start at Vauxhall and go from there, or does it go back to an older tradition of partying in Italian gardens on hot summer nights?
Yes, I suppose, you know, it is such a kind of natural instinct, really, isn't it, for us to, you know, be in gardens late at night. And there are definitely kind of earlier versions or examples of that. But this particular sort of Vauxhall format of combining a bit of culture, even public dining, you know, that was new to London at the time. People did not eat in public before Vauxhall Gardens, and this class-bending environment that included the middle class. You know, there were previously bear-baiting pits and things like that, which were entertainments for the working class and upper class, but the middle class were not part of that scene at all.
Because they were respectable. So,
exactly, exactly. That there's yes, exactly. Want to present as respectable. So there was something quite new that Vauxhall really did create. It was all down to the creativity of one man called Jonathan Tyers. And that formula then spread across the UK. Well, firstly, across London. London had a peak of around 70 pleasure gardens by sort of the end of the 18th century. So a night out in 18th century England really was 18th century London really was going to a pleasure garden, the nightclubs of their time. Spread across Europe, there were pleasure gardens then in New York, and even, you know, spread to Russia, where they built a replica of Vauxhall at the end of a railway line to entice passengers. And so the name for station in Russian is still Vauxhall today, as an echo of this this kind of history. So they really did go global, yeah.
Now look, what is it about dark? Why is dark Why is dark a key to pleasure?
Well, I think it is the anonymity that it offers us, that you're able to behave slightly differently. There isn't that same sense of kind of scrutiny or self-consciousness that we might feel in the normal daylight hours. And I think if we lose this amazing ability to go out and party after dark at night, then we do lose something very profound. So there are examples of, you know, here in London, I think for many bars in particular, their busiest trading hours have moved much earlier. It used to be sort of between 8 and 9 or 9 and 10. Now for many chain bars, it's between 3 and 4 o'clock on a Saturday. It's their busiest time. So there is evidence that we are day drinking, going out in the day to replace the big night out. But I think that by doing that, we are losing something very fundamental, because that sense of anonymity and freedom that you get after dark is pretty special.
Do you think there's also perhaps a breakdown in the distinction between the working day and the night?
Yes, I think, you know, the fact that we are able to be, you know, with sort of hyper communication that we have through our phones and always available, you know, through emails, on Slack, WhatsApp, you know, these boundaries have definitely shifted in comparison to even 20 years ago, where, you know, you would log off at the end of the day and that would be it. So it is very common for people to work very late into the night. You're absolutely right that working patterns have perhaps affected our appetite for nights out, and that's part of the story too.
You also point out in the book that a lot of nightlife can be seen as a critique of the society in which it's occurring. It's deliberately transgressive, it's political. And I suppose the example we all think of is Berlin in the 1920s and 30s.
Mm-mm. Yes, so I mean, as I talk about in the book, I think that 1920s Berlin has been a little bit misunderstood. You know, we think of Berlin as this insane party hedonistic carnival for sort of the 13 or so years between the end of the First World War and Hitler's rise to power. But a lot of our understanding of Berlin, you know, particularly for people in Britain, is through Christopher Isherwood, who's a British writer who gets to Berlin in 1929. You know, he only sees the tail end of it, you know, after the Wall Street crash. And between the Wall Street crash and Hitler becoming chancellor. But what came before that, I think, is really fascinating, because it wasn't so much this whirlwind of decadence. You know, people were too distracted by the hedonism to notice the political situation that was happening around them. It was very much selling these very shocking, outrageous cabaret experiences to tourists, not so much local Berliners. So Berlin, that was going through a very difficult time economically with hyperinflation, for many people who owned cabarets, people who worked in cabarets, it was, how on earth do you make money in an economic situation like this? Well, we can sell shock to British and American tourists who are more than happy to come to Berlin and experience this kind of city on the brink. So there's a much more of a kind of economic materialist explanation for what was going on in Berlin at that time.
Rather a novelty show.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And then for the, you know, queer people who are in Berlin at that time, you know, yes, fetish clubs were part of the scene, but the reality of their community, it was often just they were having ballroom dances, and it just sounds quite twee. You know, that was what they were doing. But that's not so much what we think of when we think of Berlin in the 1920s.
Don't you think the sight of two men ballroom dancing together is one of the saddest images in the whole world?
You're probably right, yes.
But now look, the big kind of, I don't know, nightlife invention of my existence, I suppose, has been enormous music parties, you know, enormous gatherings of people out in the bush, dancing, you know, all night. But these seem to be failing now.
Yes, yes. And I think also you know, we compare modern nightlife, you know, what we have now in the 2020s in comparison to the 18 and 90s with the rave scene, I think in a strange way, we are kind of stuck, because I could go out in London on a Friday night and dance to techno music in a kind of ruinous factory industrial environment, which is very, you know, in a sense, nightlife hasn't really moved on from the 1990s. And that's very unusual, because if you think of the decades prior to the 1990s, things were changing constantly, you know, moving from, you know, disco and then house and then techno and then jazz that came before. There was this real sense of propulsive cultural innovation and momentum. And I think that we need something new. You know, it shouldn't be the case that we are dancing to essentially the same type of music that's been around for, you know, 30 years in the same environment that's been around for 30 years. We need something new. And I think that that will recreate those enormous music parties that you're describing. People need to be inspired by newness.
But a grubby reflection on my part, I'm known for them, is that if there's no forward propulsion, it's because money isn't being made.
Well, I mean, obviously these scenes are commercial and they make money. But I think also what's interesting in researching the book is that often nightlife scenes emerged from from times of economic hardship. So New Orleans, the city that created jazz, it was not a rich city in the 1890s, but the economic challenges actually fostered this really vibrant party scene. And that's because of you know, people that were struggling with rent payments, for example, on their homes. They would have these Saturday night fish fries, where they would basically charge entry for a house party. So Saturday night, open up their doors, charge entry, have jazz bands playing, and, you know, have food, drink, and all the rest of it, a big party. And they were doing it very much kind of outside of the sort of commercial or, you know, pub bar scene. It was their own thing. So there are examples in history where people are starting something, you know, on the periphery that then builds this momentum and becomes mainstream.
Imogen, you're so reassuring. There's still a future for fun in the for the human race.
Let's hope. And I think the reason I stay optimistic is because I think Gen Alpha, you know, they are children and preteens today. I think when they come of age, it's very likely that they will reject phone culture and they will, you know, begin this hedonistic revolution that's anti-phone, that is about being hedonistic in nightlife spaces. And I think when they come of age, we could see an amazing nightlife renaissance.
And have fun. Imogen, yes. Thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking to Imogen Willits, who is the author of a new and indispensable book, Up All Night, A History of Going Out.